Am I correct that we've already talked about six?
Yeah.
Okay. The reason I'm starting with it is just to remind you that we were talking about coenzymes, specifically NAD as the main coenzyme involved here, being energy carriers, right? They are taxis that carry energy in the form of electrons and protons extracted from the fuel. But NAD is nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, and in slide 7 we can see why it gets that name. Remember what it means to be a nucleotide of any kind. To be a nucleotide, you have to have three components. A pentose sugar, to which is attached a nitrogenous base, and also to which is attached at least one phosphate. So this part, just by itself, is a nucleotide, right? This is a nucleotide that happens to have adenine, which is what this is, as its nitrogenous base. The rest of this is also a nucleotide. It has the three components. It's just that this nitrogenous base is not one of the ones that you find in DNA or in RNA. It's still a nitrogenous base, though, called nicotinamide. And when you have this nucleotide connected to this nucleotide via their phosphates, you have a dinucleotide, one that involves nicotinamide and adenine, so it's called nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. That explains the name, and this is how it's arranged. So it's a complex thing, but the business end of this molecule in terms of what it functions as, which is an electron carrier from an energy carrier, is the nicotinamide nitrogenous base shown in white here. And recall that a coenzyme has two forms, reduced and oxidized. What is the form that we're looking at here? The oxidized form, which is the empty taxi, right? NAD+. That's before it receives the electrons and protons. These two hydrogens are the two electrons and two protons. Those came from the fuel. And they can, well, three of those four things, both electrons and one proton, get added to nicotinamide. That forms NADH, plus you have an additional proton left over, and that's just in solution. But that's why we call the reduced form of NAD NADH and H+. All of the rest of this dinucleotide is still here. They just didn't repeat the information on the right side, because what's important here is what happens to the nicotinamide nitrogenous base. But never lose track of the fact that the reduced form is much higher energy than the oxidized form. It's the full taxi, and it's carrying a lot of valuable energy that used to be in the fuel and now is being carried by the taxi. Slide 8 is another combustion reaction, which, remember, involves a fuel of some sort reacting with oxygen to release energy. You can see that there's energy release here not only because of this yellow bubble, but because this thing is a graph with G on the y-axis. And you're going from an initial high G to a final low G. In other words, this is what kind of reaction? No, there's no water involved. It's exergonic. Right, it releases energy. It's also spontaneous, by the way. But that's true for combustion in general, right? The reason we call things fuels is because they can be combusted for the purpose of releasing energy that can be put to work for us. And this is not an organic fuel because it's just hydrogen gas. There is no carbon involved. But it's a good fuel. If you react it with oxygen, you release a lot of energy all at once if you do it in one step, which is why the Hindenburg exploded, because it was full of hydrogen that got sparked somehow. That might be okay if you're, you know, powering a hydrogen-powered car to release it all at once, but cells don't do that, remember. That would be too unmanageable, and it would be such a release of heat that it would kill the cell. Instead, though, we use hydrogen, not as hydrogen gas, hydrogen from the fuel that got picked off of the fuel by dehydrogenation, right? This is hydrogen, just like the hydrogen gas is, and it can be turned into water just like when you combust it directly in the left side. And so we're talking about the same starting and ending values here of G. Remember that delta G depends only on the starting and ending values of G. It doesn't depend at all how you get from beginning to end. And so this is a stepwise release of energy that cells do, but it ends up overall being exactly the same delta G. The same amount of energy gets released. Just doesn't kill the cell. It's not nearly as much as wasted as heat. Instead, a little bit of energy is released at a time, and those manageable units get put to use producing ATP. This specifically happens in a part of cellular respiration called electron transport. All right. Well, now we can look at the particulars of cellular respiration. This is slide 9, which is a summary of cellular respiration. But let's reorient ourselves because this hierarchy of processes can get confusing. The overall process is what that we're talking about in this chapter? No, that's just part of it. The overall process is the complete oxidation of glucose, which refers to using that master fuel, glucose, in such a way that you extract as much usable energy, meaning energy put into the form of ATP, as possible. That overall process then is primarily broken into two parts. Oh, I'm sorry, this is not an overview of just cellular respiration. This is an overview of the entire process. So you see both of those two parts here. The first part is glycolysis. The second part is cellular respiration. But that's just the first subdivision, right? Two main parts to the overall process. The first of those subdivisions, which is glycolysis, itself contains 10 steps. So glycolysis is not a reaction, it is a pathway consisting of 10 reactions end to end. The details aren't shown here, but the fact that there's multiple arrows here indicates that instead of glucose being turned into pyruvate in one step, it actually is a biochemical pathway that causes that to happen. And this is called glycolysis, by the way, because sugar gets split. Glyco means sugar, and lysis is splitting. The last time I mentioned that to use fuel efficiently as possible, meaning to completely oxidize the glucose, we need to entirely dismantle the carbon skeleton, and we need to entirely pick off the hydrogens. So we're starting with glucose. That is a 6-carbon compound, and it has a bunch of hydrogens in it. If we're going to go through the entire process to use as much energy as possible, we need to break apart that carbon skeleton so it's 6 individual carbons, and we need to take off all the hydrogens. If you do both of those things, what you're left with is completely spent fuel, which will be 6 individual carbon dioxide molecules. Carbon dioxide is worthless in terms of fuel. It's completely spent. Notice that each carbon dioxide has just one of the carbons that of the 6 that were in glucose, so that's the dismantling of the skeleton I was talking about. And each carbon dioxide has no hydrogens in it, so all the hydrogens have been picked off, which are the valuable things from the fuel. That's what that last slide was about. The hydrogens used in that last slide come from the fuel. Okay, so glycolysis is part one of this overall process, but it has 10 steps, which we can't see here yet. But glycolysis only partially uses the fuel. That's why it's only part of the overall process. There are, before I forget to say, glycolysis, as its own process, occurs in the cytosol. So in the cell, but outside of all the membrane-bounded organelles. That's what this brownish background represents, the cytosol, the liquid component of the cytoplasm. That's why the glycolysis box is out here. It's not in the mitochondria. There are inputs and outputs to this process of glycolysis. One input, of course, is the fuel itself, glucose. Another input is oxidized coenzyme in the form of NAD+. Empty taxis, in other words. Glycolysis can't happen unless you have empty taxis coming in to pick up the hydrogens that get removed by dehydrogenation. So that's an input, NAD+. Also, another input is ADP. ADP is valuable stuff, as we've talked about, but not as valuable as ATP. It has a lower energy balance, right? So the whole goal of this whole process is to produce ATP. ADP comes in, it's an input, and it gets turned into ATP, which is one of the three outputs. Okay, so the inputs into glycolysis are NAD+, glucose, and ADP. The outputs are NADH, because the taxi comes in and picks up the hydrogens, gets its passengers. So that's reduced coenzyme. NADH and H+ is reduced coenzyme. That's one output. Another output is pyruvate, which is partially spent fuel. You started with the full original fuel, glucose. You got some of the energy out of it, which is why you were able to reduce NAD+ into NADH. But you don't completely dismantle the fuel. So the pyruvate, and I should say the two pyruvates, because one glucose gets split into two pyruvates, those are fuel molecules still. They have not been completely spent. They're still valuable. Still energy in them that can be tapped.
So pyruvate is the split of glucose?
It is half of glucose, in a sense. Glucose is a six-carbon compound, and glycolysis splits one glucose into two three-carbon pyruvates. It's still valuable because each pyruvate still has a carbon skeleton and hydrogens that could be dismantled. So that's what happens to the glucose. That pyruvate is another output. And the third output is ATP, because in some of the energy that gets released by doing this glycolysis is put to use sticking a phosphate onto ADP, the input, to make ATP, the output. And ATP is the goal of this overall process. So the ATP that gets produced by glycolysis is the end of the line as far as it's concerned. It doesn't need to be processed. All ATP is the same, no matter where it's produced. But there isn't all that much ATP that's produced by glycolysis itself. And in some situations, a cell can conduct only glycolysis. If that's true, then it's not using glucose very efficiently because it only makes a little bit of ATP. If a cell is capable, it is certainly worth continuing where glycolysis leaves off. Glycolysis leaves off at pyruvate, which I just told you is still valuable fuel. And if you use that still valuable pyruvate, you can get a lot more energy out of what was originally glucose and produce a lot more ATP, and that's exactly what cellular respiration is. Cellular respiration uses the output of glycolysis, which is pyruvate, which is still valuable fuel, and further processes it. But whereas glycolysis happens in the cytosol, cellular respiration, which is part two of the overall process, happens in a mitochondrion, which is why you have this white arrow coming from glycolysis into the mitochondrion that's shown here in yellow. Okay, so in terms of the overall process, cellular respiration is part two of it. But cellular respiration has three major subdivisions within it. And they are not all shown here. They're not all listed. They're kind of shown. Two of them are listed, but the first part of cellular respiration isn't actually labeled here. It's represented simply by this white arrow. The first part, though, of cellular respiration is called the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. And so let's think about what this phrase means. It should make sense that the first part of cellular respiration involves something happening to pyruvate, right? Because I just told you that pyruvate is what glycolysis spits out, and cellular respiration then deals with the pyruvate. So the very first part of cellular respiration is to do something with the pyruvate. And it's what it does is decarboxylate it. Well, what is decarboxylation? It's not glucose we're talking about. It's pyruvate. We have no more glucose. It's pyruvate that enters cellular respiration. But no, that's not what decarboxylation means. What does the D part mean? What is dehydrogenation, which we already talked about? Right, removal of hydrogen. What is dephosphorylation? Removal of a phosphate. Therefore, decarboxylation is removal of a carboxyl. Exactly. And what is a carboxyl? Do you remember your functional groups? It's a carbon bonded to an oxygen and bonded to another oxygen, right? Or an OH, which has an oxygen in it. Okay, so we'll look at the particulars of that in a minute, but that's part one of cellular respiration, the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Part two of cellular respiration is listed here, and it goes by any of three names which are interchangeable. It can be called the citric acid cycle, or it can be called the Krebs cycle. Eponyms are not really valuable. They're just named after a human. They don't tell you anything about the process. Or it could be called the tricarboxylic acid cycle. Or TCA cycle. Doesn't matter which one of those you call it. But this slide is calling it the citric acid cycle. That's part two of cellular respiration. Part three of cellular respiration, represented by the lavender box here, is oxidative phosphorylation. So that's going to involve phosphorylating something, well, specifically phosphorylating ADP to make ATP. But even though this is already part three of part two in the overall process, right, it's part three of cellular respiration, it is broken down into two subphases itself. It consists of two processes, electron transport and chemiosmosis. Both of those together, electron transport and chemiosmosis, make up oxidative phosphorylation, which is the third part of cellular respiration, which is the second part of the overall process called the complete oxidation of glucose. Is everyone oriented properly with respect to the hierarchy? Well, I'll explain it when we get to a picture, but it includes electron transport and chemiosmosis. They make up the step or the part of cellular respiration, part three, called oxidative phosphorylation. Now, you can see that ATP is produced in three different places here. ATP is ATP. They're all the same molecularly, so it doesn't matter how it's produced. It's the goal, right, because you're trying to get the energy from the fuel into ATP, the production of ATP, to store that energy. They're all equally good ATPs, is what I'm saying. But the ATP produced by glycolysis and the ATP produced by the citric acid cycle are produced differently from how the ATP produced by oxidative phosphorylation is produced. We'll get to how this oxidative phosphorylation works later, but this bigger bubble of ATP doesn't mean it's more valuable ATP, it just means more of it is produced. The vast majority of the ATP that's produced in the complete oxidation of glucose is produced in the oxidative phosphorylation part of cellular respiration. The ATP produced by the citric acid cycle and by glycolysis are produced in a different way called substrate level phosphorylation. And you can tell just by looking at that phrase that that's going to involve a substrate of some sort, right? Which is something that binds to an enzyme. It's the definition of a substrate. Okay, well, let's look at that. Let's look at a picture in slide 10. Actually, before I get to slide 10, let me show you one more thing about this previous slide. NADH, which is reduced coenzyme that gets produced here in glycolysis, also gets produced in the citric acid cycle, along with a different related coenzyme called FADH2. But they're the taxis. They're carrying valuable energy in the form of electrons. They, as taxis do, deliver those passengers off to a different part, a later part of the process. They get delivered to oxidative phosphorylation, and that's how the energy cargo that they're carrying gets put into the form of ATP. But we'll look at the particulars in a bit. Now we can go to slide 10 and look at why this process of producing ATP is called substrate-level phosphorylation. It's pretty straightforward. A substrate is something that binds to an enzyme, right? So in substrate-level phosphorylation, the substrate involved, which is a different kind of substrate in different places, but it's a substrate that is phosphorylated to begin with. The green ball already has a phosphate stuck to it. So the substrate is carrying the phosphate, and then by binding to the enzyme along with ADP, which is also a substrate in this case, the phosphate gets transferred from the substrate to ADP to produce ATP. And now the substrate is dephosphorylated and gets turned into product. So that's really all there is to substrate-level phosphorylation, and that's how the ATP that's produced in glycolysis and in the citric acid cycle happens. Well, speaking of glycolysis, slide 11 is a summary of it. You still don't really see the details of glycolysis here. But the important part of this slide is that glycolysis as an overall process can be thought of as occurring in two major phases, which are the so-called energy investment phase and the so-called energy payoff phase. The energy investment phase occurs first. Now think about what the goal here is. The goal is to produce ATP, right? Well, you're doing just the opposite in the energy investment phase. The energy investment phase requires ATP to be spent rather than created, which is exactly the opposite of what you're trying to do, right? But it's the only way that you can cause this first part of glycolysis to happen. It's worth doing, though, like investments are, because of eventual payoff. You know, in terms of money, you've probably heard the phrase, it takes money to make money. You have to invest money if you expect to get a return on that investment in the form of interest. Well, here you're spending 2 ATPs per glucose. These are per glucose numbers. So for each individual glucose molecule, you have to spend 2 ATP in order for this first part to happen. But by allowing this first part to happen, it will proceed to the second part, which is the energy payoff phase. And per glucose, you have 4 ATP produced. Which means that you come out ahead, just in terms of ATP alone, because you spent two to make four. And therefore, you have a net gain of two net on the bottom. That alone is valuable. But that's only part of the energy payoff phase. In addition to the four ATP produced per glucose, you also have two reduced coenzymes, NADH and H+, produced. They're the taxis carrying energy. And they're carrying a lot more energy than ATP is, actually. When their energetic cargo gets delivered finally and put into the form of ATP, each NADH will allow for multiple ATP to be produced. So it's carrying a lot of energy, each individual NADH and H+. So that's part of the payoff. And in terms of the net on the bottom, you started with glucose, you end up with two pyruvates, also valuable because it's still fuel. You started with spending two ATPs, you end up with four ATPs, so you've earned two. And you started with oxidized coenzymes, NAD+, that get reduced into NADHs, valuable stuff. So it's definitely worth going through that investment phase to get to the payoff phase. All right, well, let's look at the individual reactions now. This is slide 12. This is not all of glycolysis. This is only the energy investment phase, the first part. Overall, as I said, there are 10 reactions in the glycolytic pathway, which is another way of saying glycolysis. This is just the first five. It shouldn't surprise you that each individual step in the pathway is catalyzed by its own enzyme. So these are enzyme names on the side. You can tell by their endings. But we start with glucose, which is a 6-carbon compound. And for several steps, we just make it into other 6-carbon compounds, meaning there is no splitting that occurs right away. The splitting doesn't occur until you get down to the bottom of this, where this fork in the road is. But notice that right away, in step one, you spend an ATP to transform glucose into glucose 6-phosphate. Now, I don't expect you to memorize all these individual reactions or intermediates. You would have to do that for a biochemistry course, but not for this course, because that's not really the point. The point here is that ATP has to be spent here. That's part of the energy investment. By spending an ATP in general, you dephosphorylate the ATP, right? The phosphate comes off of the ATP and gets stuck onto the 6th carbon of glucose. That's why it's called glucose 6-phosphate now. It's a phosphorylated glucose, which is a higher energy version of glucose. Well, that gets turned into fructose 6-phosphate, which is still another 6-carbon compound. So there is no splitting that happens. You add another phosphate down here by spending another ATP to make fructose 1,6-bisphosphate, having two phosphates. Still a 6-carbon compound, but it's doubly phosphorylated now. When you finally get to that point, then you can have the lysis part of glycolysis, which is to split this thing into smaller pieces. So the fructose 1,6-bisphosphate is split into two 3-carbon compounds. But there's two possible ways this can happen. That's why you have a fork in the road. And the cell doesn't know which is going to happen because they're equally probable, roughly equally. The two possible products when you split this 6-carbon fructose 1,6-bisphosphate into two 3-carbon compounds are dihydroxyacetone phosphate and glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, which is also called G3P. The reason I'm mentioning these two possibilities is because only one of those two possibilities can actually go on and proceed to the rest of glycolysis. That's why it has an arrow going down here to the next slide. This one doesn't. That's not actually a problem, though, because if dihydroxyacetone phosphate gets produced instead of glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, you can simply, since they're isomers of each other, turn dihydroxyacetone phosphate into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. They're isomers. They have the same chemical formula. It's just rearranged. By the way, the enzyme that does that is called isomerase for that reason. So even though they're both possible, effectively, it ends up being all glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. And on a per glucose basis, two of them, right? It takes two G3Ps to contain all six of the carbons that are in one glucose, because each G3P only has three carbons. So that's the splitting part, finally. Yeah?
Could this be an example of catabolism?
It is catabolism, yes. Yes, the glycolytic pathway, or glycolysis, is a catabolic pathway. And processing of fuels in general is. That's why we get energy out of fuels, because we catabolize them. Remember, catabolism goes hand in hand with exergonic, releasing energy. All right, so I was pointing down here to the small thing. You have a giant version on the right, but this is the end of just the energy payoff phase, the first part of glycolysis. That glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate then proceeds to the next slide at the top arrow here and enters the energy payoff phase. You've already split it into two 3-carbon compounds, so all of this happens twice, once for each of the two G3Ps. And that's why there's twos in front of these outputs. Not that it happens, not that two come in and get turned into two, but it happens for each of the two individual G3Ps. All right? So these are per glucose. But in this first step, you can see part of the energy payoff. You reduce NAD into NADH. In this step, you phosphorylate ADP into ATP. Those are both energy-carrying molecules, and down here you phosphorylate another ATP. All right, so there's two ATPs per G3P plus an NADH per G3P, but you have two of them, so that's why it's four ATP overall and two NADHs per glucose. That, if it all proceeds, will end up giving you pyruvate, the end product of glycolysis. And if that's all you do with the fuel, then those two net ATP are all you get out of valuable glucose. And that's inefficient, because there's still a lot of energy in this pyruvate. We haven't completely dismantled the carbon skeleton or picked off all the hydrogens. So if you want to get all the energy out of it, then you can proceed with step two of the overall process, which is cellular respiration. That deals with the pyruvate. Let's look at that in 14. Well, remember what I said a little bit earlier. Cellular respiration has three parts to it, the first of which is called the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Pyruvate, when it's produced, is out in the cytosol, because that's where glycolysis happens, and glycolysis produces the pyruvate. So part of this first step, the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, is to get the fuel, pyruvate, into the mitochondrion. That's this white arrow. Recall that a mitochondrion is a doubly membrane-bounded organelle. So this light orange layer is the outer membrane. The dark orange here is the intermembrane space. This other light orange is the inner membrane. Pyruvate has to go through all of that to enter the light yellow here, which is the mitochondrial matrix. That's where cellular respiration happens. But it's more than just importing the pyruvate, because the pyruvate gets changed in this process, releasing some of its energy. It's still fuel, right? Still has three carbons. You can see the structural formula of pyruvate. It's a 3-carbon compound, and remember, you have two of these because you broke apart 1,6-carbon glucose. So all of this happens twice, once for each of the two pyruvates. But look at the structural formula. One of those carbons is connected to oxygens, and a different pH, this would be an OH, but its cellular pH is the proton leaves. That's why it's an O minus. But here you have, in whatever color this is, a carboxyl group, right? And if you remove that carboxyl, that's decarboxylation. That's why this first part is called oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Well, when you remove the carboxyl, which is a carbon and two oxygens, what comes off is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is completely spent fuel. In terms of getting energy out of it or using it as a fuel, it is worthless. Which is why, as cells are doing this process and producing this CO2, it accumulates in the cells and therefore diffuses into the blood, gets carried by the bloodstream to the lungs, diffuses into the air inside the lungs, and then we exhale it because it's not worth anything to us in terms of energy. Now, that is only one of the six carbons that are in glucose originally, right? The carbon dioxide. But there's two of these because you have two pyruvates. So that's two of the six carbons that were in glucose that have been put to the final worthless stage of CO2. You still, though, in each of the two pyruvates that came in, have two carbons remaining. So this remaining part, after you decarboxylate the pyruvate, is still valuable fuel itself. And that two-carbon fuel is called acetyl, just this part, just the two magenta C's and the other atoms, without this stuff in brown. That's what's left of the fuel at that point, after this first part, acetyls. They get picked up, though. There's two of them because you have this happening twice, remember. But the acetyl, which is the remaining fuel, gets picked up by a different version of a taxi. Another coenzyme. Just like NAD is a taxi and it's a coenzyme, this one is called coenzyme A, also operating as a taxi. But its job is to pick up what remains of the fuel, which is acetyl. And when it gets picked up, this whole complex is therefore called acetyl coenzyme A. Before it picks it up, it's just coenzyme A. And then it picks up the acetyl group and becomes acetyl coenzyme A. Its job is, the taxi's job, is to deliver that acetyl to the next part in the process of cellular respiration, which is part two of cellular respiration, specifically the citric acid cycle. And then drop it off there. The thing I didn't mention, which is really important, is that in this process of converting pyruvate into acetyl, more empty taxis get filled. And NAD plus, the oxidized form of the coenzyme, gets reduced into NADH and H plus. You made some of that in glycolysis. It's valuable stuff. This is equally valuable. Now, there is no ATP produced directly in this step. But remember, NADH and H plus is even more valuable than ATP and will eventually be used to make multiple ATPs later. All right, that's part one. 15 shows you part one again, but it also shows you part two, all in one slide. So this top part is what we just went over. That's the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Not all the atoms are shown, just for simplicity, just the carbons are shown. So pyruvate is a three-carbon compound. You have two of them, remember, but for each of them, this happens. The three-carbon compound, pyruvate, gets converted into acetyl because it gets decarboxylated, liberating carbon dioxide, totally spent fuel. In the process, coenzyme A picks up what's left, which is the acetyl, forming acetyl coenzyme A, and drives that two-carbon fuel, acetyl, to the citric acid cycle and drops it off. That's going to leave the empty taxi again, and it can go pick up more. It's just over and over. It shuttles back and forth. And also in this process, some of the energy that's released by breaking down the pyruvate into acetyl gets put into reducing NAD plus into NADH. So that NADH is carrying some of the energy that was originally in glucose, and that before then was in sunlight, before the glucose was made by the plant. Okay, now the citric acid cycle is called a cycle because even though it's a pathway, like other pathways we've looked at, the end reaction in the pathway feeds the beginning reaction again. So it just keeps going over and over. But only if you keep adding acetyl to it will it continue, because you can see that things come out as well. You can't have something continue if only things come out. You have to keep adding things to it to make it continue. And what you keep adding to it are acetyls, two carbon compounds, one at a time. The details of the citric acid cycle are not shown here. I mean, not all the individual details, but what's important as far as fuel and energy storing compounds is concerned is shown. Notice that two carbon dioxides come off individually, not at the same time, but it's summarized here. Now that means two carbon dioxides per acetyl. You have two acetyls though, because you had two pyruvates, right? So really it's four carbon dioxides that are coming off, but the two carbon dioxides represent the two carbons that are still together in acetyl. That gets dismantled. No more hydrogen left, just individual carbon dioxides, totally spent fuel. And since that's happening to each of the two acetyls, that means you have four carbon dioxides coming out of the citric acid cycle, plus the two that you have from earlier, right? You have a CO2 for each of the two pyruvates. That adds up to six carbon dioxides. That represents all of your fuel. You started with a six carbon compound, and by the time you're at the end of the citric acid cycle, you have six individual carbon dioxide molecules, all of which are worthless as fuel. That means the citric acid cycle completely spends what's left of the fuel, and there is no more fuel. In the process, though, some of the energy that was in that fuel before it got turned into CO2 gets put into the form of NADH, NH+, and FADH2. Now, we haven't talked about FAD, but it's a different coenzyme, very similar to nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, except that instead of having nicotinamide as its nitrogenous base in that position, it has flavin. So FAD stands for flavin adenine dinucleotide. The rest of the molecule is the same. And the two coenzymes, FAD and NAD, do the same job. They pick up electrons and protons from hydrogens in the fuel and deliver it somewhere else later in the process. So just like NAD has two forms, the oxidized lower energy form and the higher energy reduced form, so does FAD. But remember what the oxidized form of NAD is. What is that? No, it's NAD plus. Did I say reduced? I said oxidized, didn't I? Yeah. Yeah, the oxidized is NAD plus. That's the low energy. And that's why, remember, it takes one of the electrons from the hydrogens just to make it NAD, and then another electron and proton in the form of a hydrogen atom to make it NADH, and you have a leftover proton. Well, FAD's oxidized form is FAD, not FAD plus. So it can take all four particles that the two hydrogens are made out of, two electrons and two protons, and therefore the reduced form of FAD is FADH2. There is no leftover proton. But it's doing the same job as NADH and H+, just with a different molecule. And that, those two combined, the three NADHs, six really, because this is all happening twice, and the two FADH2s really represent a lot of the energy that was originally in glucose. You don't have any fuel left, but you have energy stored from that fuel in the form of these reduced coenzymes. That'll pay off later. In addition, at the bottom here, you produce some more ATP, which is the goal. And just like in glycolysis, this ATP produced by the citric acid cycle is produced via substrate level phosphorylation. Yeah.
So for the acetyl coenzyme A,
yeah,
it has carbons in it, correct?
Two, yes. So, the acetyl is what is remaining of the original fuel, but just two carbons are in it. And oxygen and hydrogen as well.
And when it goes inside the citric acid cycle, the two carbons are released?
They're split apart and become one carbon in an individual carbon dioxide each. That's why there's two carbon dioxides. So what the citric acid cycle does is complete the dismantling of the fuel. It's already been partially dismantled by glycolysis and the decarboxylation of pyruvate. Now it gets completely dismantled. You don't have multiple carbons anymore stuck together. You have individual carbon dioxides, no hydrogens left. That's why it's completely spent, worthless fuel. And we just get rid of it. Okay, that doesn't show you the details. We can see more details in slide 16. These are showing you the individual reactions that make up the cycle. Like I said before, you don't have to memorize it as intermediates, but let's look at two of them, though, at the top. This cycle has what the 12 o'clock position at the top here is really like a start-finish line. It's the first reaction here, and then the last reaction goes back to the first reaction. So it's a start. That's what I mean by start-finish line. And it's right at the start-finish line that acetyl gets dropped off by coenzyme A to get added to that cycle. Now think about what the goal overall here is. The goal is to complete the breakdown of the carbon skeleton, right? To dismantle the fuel. And right away, it looks like we're going in the opposite direction again, just like it seemed like that for pyruvate, for glycolysis. This end product, it's not really the end because it's a cycle, but if this were not a cycle, this would be the last product. It's called oxaloacetate. And notice from the structural formula that it has four carbons. It's a four-carbon compound. Acetyl gets dropped off by coenzyme A, and acetyl has two carbons that get added to oxaloacetate to produce citrate, which has six carbons in it. So instead of dismantling a carbon skeleton, you're making an even bigger carbon skeleton. That's what I meant by it seems like it's backwards. But by doing that, then the rest of this can happen, and it ends up dismantling the carbons that were in the acetyl. This six-carbon compound that you see here is citrate, because this what would be a COOH has been deprotonated at this pH, which is why it's a negative. The same exact thing, but with a proton still here, so it would be COOH, would be called citric acid. When acids are in water, they lose their protons. That's what makes them acids. So citrate and citric acid are really the same thing except for that proton, and that's why it's called the citric acid cycle, because of this first intermediate. But once you get to that point, then it gets stepwise changed, and in two of these steps, one of the six carbons gets popped off. One of the six that were originally in glucose, I should say, or more directly, one of the two that enters as acetyl. So these are the two individual carbons of acetyl. And that's why that fuel is no longer fuel. It's completely spent. And the same thing happens for the other acetyl that came from the other pyruvate, right? So that would be four carbon dioxides plus the two in the earlier step. That's the six. No more fuel at that point. But importantly, you have a bunch of energy in the form of NADH, produced three places, and FADH2. That's carrying most of the energy that was originally in glucose, temporarily. It's going to pay off after this. But you also make some ATP by substrate level phosphorylation. Well, that brings us to 17 then. So we're done with part two of cellular respiration, which is the citric acid cycle. The third part, remember, is called oxidative phosphorylation, And it actually has two subparts, which are electron transport and chemiosmosis. This figure shows you electron transport, the first of the two processes that make up oxidative phosphorylation. This is a slide that has dual purpose. It's kind of an anatomical slide because it shows you these purple protein complexes that are real structures, and they are arranged the way they are here, kind of an end-to-end arrangement, to form one copy of what is called an electron transport chain. So the actual structure is called the electron transport chain. The process is called electron transport. A lot of textbooks will talk about the electron transport chain like there's one. There's millions of them. But they're all the same for cellular respiration, and this is just one of them. Anatomically speaking, where you have each electron transport chain, many, many copies of them, is embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane. So the membrane isn't shown here, but this whole complex and all the other copies that are just like it are part of the inner mitochondrial membrane. Think back to when we first talked about mitochondria, and I said that the inner mitochondrial membrane is actually much bigger than the outer mitochondrial membrane. How can that be? How is the inner membrane even bigger than the outer membrane? Because it's folded many times into folds called cristae. Well, why do you have those folds? More surface area into which you can embed more copies of electron transport chains. The more electron transport chains you have, the more they can all simultaneously be doing their job, which we're going to talk about in a minute, and therefore the more energy processing that can occur. That's going to pay off in terms of more ATP produced in a given amount of time. Highly increases the efficiency of it, in other words. So that's the anatomical part of this slide. It's also, though, a graph. Notice it has a y-axis here, which is G, free energy. The higher up, the greater the value of G. And that's important for what this electron transport chain accomplishes, which I'll get to. But the electron transport chain, as its name implies, involves transport of electrons. It's an old-fashioned analogy at this point, but I usually compare the electron transport chain to a bucket brigade. Now, do you know what I mean by a bucket brigade, or is it too old-fashioned? A bucket brigade is a bunch of neighbors getting together out in the country where there is no fire department, barns burning, you have a well nearby, but distance between the well, which is the only source of water, and the burning barn, the neighbors get together. Instead of them wasting energy running back and forth between the well and the barn, they form a line. Person next to the well dips the bucket in, gets water out, passes it to the next person, and so on down the line. The last person throws it onto the fire, and just that goes over and over. This is the same thing, only with passing electrons from member to member of the chain instead of buckets of water.
Does this still correspond between spillage too? Because obviously there's spillage from the bucket.
The spillage is represented by the release of heat, which doesn't do any work. But there's nothing you can do about it. But that's a good part of the analogy. Okay, now if it's electrons that are being transported along this chain, chemically speaking, what is happening? How would you describe the process if it's transporting electrons? Of course.
Second law of thermodynamics.
Well, that's what I was talking about by the wasted heat. That's the second law. But how would you describe transport of electrons, chemically speaking?
reduction?
Yes, reduction and oxidation. In other words, electron transport, involving the electron transport chain, is really a series of redox reactions. When the first member of the chain receives electrons, what is happening to that first member? No, it's receiving the electrons, and therefore, what's happening to it? It's being reduced. But just like the person with the bucket, it's not going to hang on to those electrons. It's going to pass them on to the second member, and that's going to reoxidize that first member, right? And it's going to reduce the second member, which is going to pass it to the third member, and so on. It's a bunch of redox reactions. This is where the graph part comes into play. Every time an electron gets passed from member to member, the electron ends up getting a little bit closer to the atomic nucleus that it's associated with. We talked about this before when we looked at methane's combustion, that slide. When an electron gets closer to a nucleus, that means it's going down in energy, right? It's going to a lower energy level. That means the G value is reduced, is decreased, I should say. That's why this is arranged diagonally, because every time an electron gets passed, it releases a little bit of energy. This is the stepwise release of energy that all of those analogies about multi-step hydroelectric plants were about. Instead of it being one release of energy all at once in one step, which would kill the cell, a little bit of energy gets released at a time by these electrons passing from member to member. Now, if you think of the bucket brigade example again, the last person in line will receive a bucket eventually. And if that person can't spill it onto the fire, he's stuck holding a bucket and can't receive another bucket from the previous person. And therefore, just the whole line will back up. It'll fill up with buckets and no more movement, right? Similarly, in the electron transport chain, the only way electrons can continue to be transported down the chain is if something takes the electrons from the last member in the chain, just like dumping the bucket onto the fire. Well, the transport of electrons through the chain is what makes that process called respiration. That's why this is cellular respiration gets its name. The electron transport is the heart of respiration. That's the necessary thing for respiration, for something to be called respiration. And for it to continue, like I said, you have to have something taking the electron from the last member of the chain. For most organisms that are capable of respiration, including us, that thing that takes electrons from the last member of the chain is oxygen. Oxygen serves as the final electron acceptor in cellular respiration. And that is almost the only reason you need oxygen. The oxygen you breathe goes into receiving electrons at the end of each electron transport chain. Not only electrons, by the way, which are the things trickling through the chain, but also protons. Keep in mind that electrons and protons are what were moved from the fuel originally, right, in the form of hydrogen atoms. They get separated and go their own way for a while. But eventually, electron and proton come together again. Not the same two, but an electron and a proton both get put onto the final electron acceptor. In other words, oxygen receives hydrogen to become water. So the oxygen that you breathe gets incorporated into a water molecule that you produce by adding hydrogens from the food you eat to produce that water. In organisms that use oxygen as the final electron acceptor, which I said is most respiring organisms, that version of respiration is therefore called aerobic respiration. Aerobic meaning using oxygen. involving oxygen. That's not the only kind of respiration, though. If you have electron transport chains operating in a different species, but that species uses something other than oxygen as the final electron acceptor, then it's still respiration, but it's called anaerobic respiration. All right. Now think about, before I get to that, what is the well is the source of water in the bucket brigade. What is the source of the electrons in electron transport? Well, cheat and look. Up here. No. Right. Coenzymes. All along I've been talking about how valuable these reduced coenzymes are because they're carrying energy in the form of electrons from the fuel, right? They've picked it up at different places. Some NADH was made in glycolysis because it picked off some hydrogens there. Some NADH and H+ was made in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, part one of cellular respiration. Some NADH and H+, plus some FADH2 was produced in the citric acid cycle because even more hydrogens were picked off of what was remaining of the fuel. And all of those taxis carrying these electrons and protons are driving to the electron transport chains and getting rid of their passengers. That's the source of the electrons. The electrons came from the fuel, but they were delivered to the electron transport chains by the reduced coenzymes. Okay? And more taxis can continue to deliver electrons only if you have something at the other end, like oxygen, taking them off. In the absence of oxygen, this last member won't be able to pass its electrons off. It's filled up. So this one can't pass it to the last one. It will fill up. The entire chain will fill up with electrons. And these full taxis cannot get rid of their passengers anymore. So everything will come to a halt. Or would if it weren't for something I'll mention later. Okay, but as long as you have reduced coenzymes bringing new electrons from more fuel, and as long as you have oxygen receiving those electrons at the other end, then you can continue to have electron transport. But think about what happened in the previous step, citric acid cycle. There's no more fuel. The fuel is gone because all you had is CO2 at that point, right? So no more energy there. You've made some ATP, but not all that much. So not very much energy there. You've lost some energy as heat along the way. There's nothing you can do about that. Before electron transport, all of the usable energy that wasn't already in the form of ATP, but that was in glucose originally, is in the form of the reduced coenzyme, the full taxis. Well, now the taxis are empty because they've delivered it in the electron transport chain. So you don't have any fuel and you don't have any reduced coenzymes anymore. The high-energy electrons lose their energy as they go through the electron transport chain, so you also don't even have any high-energy electrons anymore. All of that energy has been released. And notice that there is no ATP being produced here. So this would be a waste unless the release of energy does you some good. And it does, of course. That's because three of these four complexes, there's four complexes overall, 1, 2, 3, and 4, the big protein complexes, those are Roman numerals, that should be IV. Three of those four, the three biggest ones, which are 1, 3, and 4, do double duty. They are members of the chain, so they transport electrons. That's one of their jobs. But those three also function as proton pumps. Now, what are pumps in general?
Enzymes.
They're not enzymes. Well, they can be enzymes, but I mean, in general, a pump is a transport protein, right? A pump is a transport protein specifically working for the type of transport we call active transport. Meaning that that transport protein is moving something against its gradient. These are proton pumps. We already looked at some proton pumps earlier, different from these. But what is true of any pump as far as requirements are concerned? Exactly. Any pump requires a source of energy external to the system, or it's not going to work. Well, the proton pumps we already looked at, like in that plant cell example, were powered by ATP. These pumps, it would be silly to power these pumps by ATP because the goal of this whole process is to produce ATP, right? So it's not ATP that's the source of energy to power these pumps. What is the source of energy? Indirectly, but what's the direct source of energy? Indirectly also, even more indirectly. The direct source of energy powering the pumps is the energy that's released a little bit at a time as electrons transport through the chain. Okay, you're losing G value each time. Well, some of that's lost as heat, but some of it goes into actually powering 1, 3, and 4 complexes as pumps. Now, keep in mind anatomically where this whole chain is. It's embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane, exactly where you'd expect a transport protein to be, right? And so, powered by the loss of energy, the release of energy by the transport of electrons, these three complexes grab onto protons and pump them against their gradient through the membrane to the other side. Specifically, the pumps pick up protons or hydrogen ions, same thing, from the mitochondrial matrix and pump them into the intermembrane space through the inner membrane that they're part of. All right, so you have no fuel left, you have no reduced coenzymes left, you have no electron energy left either by the time they go all the way through. So where is the remaining useful energy that was originally in glucose? What very important thing did I tell you about gradients to keep in mind? They're a source of energy, exactly. So you spend all this energy that the electrons are releasing to pump protons, creating a proton gradient, which is now the energy that used to be in glucose. You're storing the energy that was some of the energy that was originally in glucose in the form of a proton gradient that gets produced by pumping the protons from the matrix to the intermembrane space. And like any gradient, if it's set up properly, that can do some work for you. Well, the work, as we'll see in the next slide, is the final payoff. The work is producing a bunch of more ATP molecules. It doesn't happen here, but ATP can't be produced in the next step unless you first have a gradient of protons. And that's what electron transport accomplishes. It establishes the proton gradient, which is then going to be used. All right? You have questions about this before I go on? Okay, let's go to 18 then. We just looked in 17 at electron transport, which is the first subdivision of oxidative phosphorylation. Here we're looking at the second part of oxidative phosphorylation, which is chemiosmosis. That's the part in which ATP actually gets produced in a way differently from how it was produced earlier. Remember that the ATP produced in the two places earlier, glycolysis and citric acid cycle, was produced via substrate level phosphorylation. This is oxidative phosphorylation, so a substrate carrying the phosphate is not involved. It's phosphate just on its own, inorganic phosphate, that gets added to ADP in this process. Now, this requires a molecular machine to do this, which is what we're looking at one copy of. Just like a chain, electron transport chain, there's millions of these. This is just one of them. But each one is a complex thing. It is literally a molecular machine because it moves around. It has a movement to it. There's two major parts to the overall thing, and the overall molecular machine is called ATP synthase. The ASE ending tells you that it's operating as an enzyme. Syn means together. To synthesize means to bring two things together. And specifically what ATP synthase brings together or synthesizes is ADP and inorganic phosphate, which when they're brought together produces ATP, the goal. As far as the machine is concerned, though, ATP synthase is made up of two major parts. There is a stator, which is called that because it is static or stationary. It does not move with respect to the other one. It's held in place in the membrane. This is not the plasma membrane. This is the inner mitochondrial membrane. Same membrane that the electron transport chains are part of. They're just not shown here. They would be right next door. Okay, so the stator doesn't move, and the other part is the rotor, which does move. It rotates with respect to the stator. Just like in an electrical motor, you have a stator and a rotor. Now, think about this gradient that just got produced because of electron transport. I told you that the three complexes in the electron transport chain that work as pumps pump the protons from the matrix, yellow part, through the membrane to the intermembrane space. So that means the gradient that is established is such that there's a higher concentration of protons in the intermembrane space than in the matrix. A concentration gradient is a tendency for diffusion to happen, right? But think back to what I said in the lab. For diffusion to actually happen, there has to be not only a gradient, but also a way for the particle to get from A to B, namely here from the intermembrane space to the matrix. That's where the protons want to get to, the matrix. They want to go back to where they were pumped from, right? Down their own gradient. They want to diffuse, in other words. Well, they don't care how they get there, they just want to get there. But these are protons, and even though they're tiny, they can't easily get directly through the phospholipid bilayer because the positively charged proton does not want to be around these neutral hydrophobic tails. So they're trying to get through everywhere in the membrane, but there's only one type of place. There's many copies of this. But the only places they can get through are at the ATP synthase molecules, which are like little turnstiles. You have a crowd of people trying to get into a stadium, but they can only get in through the turnstiles. And that's where the rotor comes into play. This rotor of the ATP synthase will rotate only if protons are diffusing through to turn it. Exactly analogous to a water wheel, which is not going to turn on its own, right? A water wheel is only going to turn if water is spilling downhill on it to turn it. So it's the diffusion of protons that turns the rotor. At the other end of the rotor, facing the mitochondrial matrix side, is this catalytic knob. So-called because it involves catalysis. It's a catalyst. Well, there are several different sections of the knob, and each of these is identical to the others. Each of them is by itself an enzyme. specifically an enzyme that is able to catalyze the synthesis of inorganic phosphate with ADP to produce ATP. But that enzyme will work for that process only if it gets deformed into the correct shape. And it will get deformed only if the rotor is turning. And the rotor will turn only if protons are diffusing through the whole thing. So this is how the diffusion of protons, in other words, how the gradient is used to do some work. The work performed is the phosphorylation, the oxidative phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. That's the final payoff. And the vast majority of the ATP that's produced in the overall process is in this final stage. There's only a little bit produced earlier on. So I have to quit there. That's the final payoff.